15-story high-rise 5 miles away. This was symbolic. They were sitting in an ivory tower while all the doers were back at Appliance Park making white appliance boxes. Armed with my group's analysis, I went to Dance to recommend a significant cutback in the business he had managed for so many years. I was prepared for Dance to fight, but he didn't. Instead, I think he might have seen my recommendation as further proof of my impulsiveness. He approved my plan. We moved quickly to make the business in Louisville more competitive by significantly downsizing what we had, scrapping plans for building additional appliance parks. The layoffs were not popular in Louisville. I was fortunate to have an ally in Dick Donegan, a Dance and Galt appointee who was running the appliance business. He bought into the new plans and had the courage to act on them, in spite of his prior relationships. Though the painful changes at Appliance Park still didn't solve all the cost problems, they did make us more competitive, improved our profitability, and kept us going. In appliances, similar actions have gone on for more than 20 years. A business that employed just over 47,000 people in 1977 today employs less than half that total, some 19,800 salaried and hourly workers. These downsizings are awful, as hardworking people get hammered by competitive change. In difficult businesses, these changes never end. I can't tell you how often I was asked in the early 1980s, "Is it over now?" Unfortunately, it's never over. A lot of the products that fueled the post-war boom simply became commodities, products with wafer-thin margins in slow-growing markets. Those changes drove many competitors out of the appliance business, from Ford Motors Philco and GM's Frigidaire to Westinghouse. GE chose to stay and fight in a very tough industry. In order to stay alive in the business, however, we had to manufacture more of these products outside the United States. The price of a refrigerator today is $700 to $800, down from an average of $1,000 to $1,200 in 1980. The only good thing about this fiercely competitive industry is that Asian competitors up to now have made few inroads into the U.S. market. That appliance experience contrasts with the experience of the U.S. automotive industry, where steady price increases invited all kinds of foreign competition. Of all the businesses I was given as a sector executive in 1977, none seemed more promising to me than GE Credit Corporation. Like plastics, it was well out of the mainstream, and like plastics, I sensed it was filled with growth potential. No one paid much attention to GE Credit. It was the orphan child in a manufacturing company. We entered the business in 1933, almost by default, helping our appliance dealers move their inventories of refrigerators and stoves in the midst of the Depression by providing consumers with credit. We also financed furniture sales because most of our dealers carried those lines as well. But that's about all we did for the first 20 years, from the 1930s until the 1950s. Then we branched out and financed Caterpillar construction equipment, what we called yellow iron. It wasn't until the late 1960s that we started leasing other equipment. By the late 1970s, GE Credit had become diversified but was still small. By then, we were financing manufactured houses, second mortgages, commercial real estate, industrial loans and leases, and private label credit cards. In those early days, I didn't understand the intricacies of finance. I had the staff prepare a book that translated all the jargon into layman's terms. I called it Finance for Little Folks, but it was just what I needed. I studied it like I was back in grad school, so I could be conversant with the people in the business. My gut told me that compared to the industrial operations I did know, this business seemed an easy way to make money. You didn't have to invest heavily in R&D, build factories, and bend metal day after day. You didn't have to build scale to be competitive. The business was all about intellectual capital, finding smart and creative people, and then using GE's strong balance sheet. This thing looked like a gold mine to me. Leveraging brain power is easier than grinding out products. Nowhere was the finance-manufacturing comparison more obvious than in profits per employee. With fewer than 7,000 employees, GE Credit's net income in 1977 was $67 million. In contrast, it took a payroll of more than 47,000 employees and appliances to make $100 million. I'm sure this is obvious to almost everyone today, but to me, it was a big insight in 1977. After all, I was a chemical engineer who had known only about making things. GE Credit wasn't doing badly in the late 1970s. Its profits and business grew every year. I just didn't think it was growing fast enough, given its vast opportunity. In my early meetings with the leaders of the business in the spring of 1978, I was underwhelmed by the people in the organization. I'd gather them together in a room, several layers worth of management, and grill them about the ins and outs of their business. "Let's pretend we're in high school," I said. "Take me through the basics." During one of the more memorable instances, I recall asking a pretty simple question of one of our insurance leaders. During his presentation, he had been using a couple of terms that I was unfamiliar with. So I interrupted him to ask, "What's the difference between facultative and treaty insurance?" After fumbling through a long answer for several minutes, an answer I wasn't getting, he finally blurted out in exasperation, "How do you expect me to teach you in 5 minutes what it has taken me 25 years to learn?" Needless to say, he didn't last long. The insurance anecdote wasn't an isolated incident. It was par for the course. If GE Credit could make as much money as it did with the existing people, I wondered how much more potential the business would have if it were filled with nothing but A players. We didn't have enough stars to capitalize on what looked to me like easy pickings. John Stanger, who was then leading the business, was a shrewd dealmaker. He was a product of the system and didn't want to rock the boat. John had a tendency to take what he was given in people, and he hadn't been exposed to the talent pool in many other parts of the company. During the Session C Human Resources reviews in the spring of 1978, I challenged all of the GE Credit managers. We had a rough first day. After the review, we invited everyone to the nearby Landmark Club in Stamford to get a better feel for them in a social atmosphere. In general, most didn't look any better after hours than they did during the day. Stanger was plenty smart. All we had to do was get him exposed to better people. Once he got them, he flourished. Over the next couple years, we changed more than half the leadership team in GE Credit. Many of the newcomers were recruited from other parts of GE. Many came from deep down in the organization. They made a big difference. There was one executive in place at GE Credit who stood out like no other. He was a brusque, smart, funny, quick-talking guy who ran the commercial and industrial financing operation. His name was Larry Bossidy, and when I first met him, I thought, "Where the hell did you come from?" I met him in early 1978 in Hawaii at a management meeting for GE Credit. Somehow, we found ourselves playing a game of ping-pong at an outside table. We were playing as if our lives depended on it, diving into hedges and sweating bullets. It was intense, with each of us whacking the heck out of this little white ball. Carolyn was calling from the balcony of our hotel room to remind me we had to catch a plane. I didn't want to leave. I was excited by this guy who was so full of life and so competitive. After the game, I couldn't let go of him. He impressed me with his quick wit and sharp observations that reinforced my instincts about the lackluster quality of middle management at GE Credit. After thinking I had found a star, Larry dropped a bomb. He confided that he was ready to leave the company for a job at Lone Star Cement. He was just as frustrated with the bureaucracy as I was years before. I asked him to hang on. "What the hell do you want to go to a cement company for?" "This place is driving me nuts," he replied. "Give me a chance," I said. "You're just what we need. This is going to be a different place." Bossidy stayed. A year later, in 1979, with Reg's support, I made him chief operating officer of GE Credit. He and Stanger set the stage for what would become our most important growth business. After I became chairman, Larry moved to Fairfield as a sector executive in 1981, and 3 years later, became one of my vice chairmen. He would be a great partner for the next 7 years before leaving to run his own show as CEO of Allied Signal. Larry's early role at GE Capital was essential. From that small base in 1977, a business earning $67 million with fewer than 7,000 employees, GE Capital has grown explosively. In 2000, the business had $5.2 billion in earnings with more than 89,000 employees, thanks to an incredible succession of leaders. Not everything I touched turned out so well. In the middle of the succession race, I pursued a major acquisition to increase our exposure in the broadcast business. I negotiated with my business development head, Norm Blake, the purchase of the Cox Communications cable and broadcasting operations. In the spring of 1978, I sold the board of directors on the deal, confident that the acquisition was a very good one for GE. We already owned a few TV stations, and GE was, in fact, one of the pioneers in cable. The company had decided to exit the cable business in the 1970s because it believed the industry was too regulated. Norm and I felt differently. We believed cable had a great future and was on the verge of breaking out. Reg agreed. Over the next 14 months, as we worked to get all the necessary approvals at the Federal Communications Commission, cable TV began to explode. I wanted to get a head start on Cox, so I transferred Bob Wright from Plastics down to Cox's Atlanta headquarters to head up the cable interests in anticipation of our taking control of Cox Broadcasting. Having seen Bob's leadership in Plastics sales, I thought his outgoing personality and legal background would be perfect for the rapidly expanding cable industry. The Cox management loved Bob, but as time for FCC approval dragged on, the Cox family began to raise the price tag on the deal. It was becoming increasingly clear to me that they regretted signing the contract with us. The Cox team had done some clever lawyering. Our agreement turned out to be less a contract to buy the business and more an option for Cox to sell at their discretion. The contract allowed Cox an out. Perhaps I should have caught this, but I didn't. I had gone out on a limb to convince Reg and the board that this deal at several hundred million dollars was a good one. Now, with the price escalating every time Norm and I met with the Cox people, I was coming to the conclusion the deal couldn't get done at any price. The Cox family had changed their mind about selling and was using the price as a way to end it. Losing this big deal in the politically charged atmosphere of a succession race was a potential disaster. With all that was riding on it, the acquisition and my own future at GE, we wanted the deal badly. Norm and I spent hours agonizing over whether they would ever close. We didn't want to give up. Norm had been with me in the plastics business, and our families were close. For about 10 days, we never stopped debating it, in the office or at each other's homes. After all that soul-searching, I finally decided we had to walk. I informed Reg about my decision during the summer of 1979. He agreed, but asked me to explain the rationale to the full board at its next meeting, which was in St. Louis. Now I not only had to bare my soul to Reg, I also had to face all of the company's directors. The upcoming board meeting was the time of an annual golf outing of senior executives and board members. This only added to the drama of having to go in and eat crow on a deal I had been touting so hard for over a year. I didn't know what to expect, but I put my best face in what was a difficult situation. In an early morning board session, I made the case for not chasing the deal. The directors asked lots of questions, including why not keep raising the price. Having dealt with the Cox negotiators for the last 6 weeks, I felt down to my toes that the Cox family wasn't going to sell to us no matter what, but I couldn't prove it. Continuing to chase it wasn't right for GE. I thought the meeting went well. I was hoping the directors would overlook my inability to close the deal and appreciate that I faced a tough call. I had little idea what they really thought. I got a somewhat positive reaction that afternoon when I was playing golf with three of them. As I was teeing up my ball on a short par three, one of the board members, Dick Baker, former head of Ernst & Whinney and a man with a great sense of humor, quipped, "I hope the fact that you screwed up today won't bother you on this shot." My 7-iron fell out of my hands, and I yelled, "Foul!" The other two directors in the foursome broke out in laughter. I took it as a positive sign, because it was the first time I had seen this crowd of generally serious people joking around. I didn't think they'd be doing it at my expense if I weren't in good shape. Later, I found out that some directors concerned about my competitiveness liked the fact that I could walk away from a deal. In the background of all these changes was Reg's succession. Everyone in the race was trying to outshine everyone else. We were all working our butts off trying to differentiate ourselves. I didn't get any feedback from my boss, Dance. The changes I pushed at GE Credit, for example, didn't receive support or opposition from him. And I really wasn't sure where Reg stood. In my gut, I always felt he was with me, but I never knew for sure. This was a horse race, but all the jockeys and horses were blind. No one, other than Reg, knew who was ahead or behind in the race. And Reg wasn't about to tell any candidate where he stood in the game. The hall gossip made everyone think that his favorite was Al Way, who shared Reg's roots in finance and as CFO worked closely with him every day. Al helped engineer Reg's largest acquisition, Utah International, and had also helped him dispose of our losing computer business to Honeywell Incorporated. Meanwhile, Dance's support of Galt, who was running the industrial sector, never wavered, nor did Parker's support of Burlingame and Hood. My nose and my gut sensed that Reg approved of what I was doing, but I was still nagged by doubts. Those uncertainties caused me to consider leaving GE in the midst of the race. Like everyone at GE, I was always getting contacted by headhunters. This time, with the self-doubt swirling in me, I reacted positively to a telephone call from Jerry Roach of Hedrick & Struggles, the search firm, and looked at the CEO job at Allied Chemical. In retrospect, I was testing the waters, not really wanting to leave GE, but not sure where I stood in the race. That lack of self-confidence was rearing its ugly head. At the time, there was much I didn't know about the succession process. I had no idea then that the initial list of 19 candidates put together in late 1974, when I was still in Pittsfield, failed to include my name. I didn't know that when the list was narrowed to 10 names by early 1975, I still wasn't on it. I didn't know that Roy Johnson, the human resources executive, had kept me off the lists. One official HR view of me stated at the time, "Not on best candidate list despite past operating success. Emerging issue is overwhelming results focus. Intimidating subordinate relationships. Seeds of company stewardship concerns. Present business adversity will severely test. Watching closely." The translation was simple. Johnson thought I was too young and too brash and didn't have the GE monogram stamped in my forehead. He thought I drove too hard for the results I got and had little respect for the company's rituals and traditions. Despite Johnson's reservations, Reg insisted on tossing me into the mix. He thought my results earned me at least the chance to compete for his job. I was identified as a person targeted for intensive development, in other words, bigger jobs. Fortunately, by 1976, Ted Levino had succeeded Johnson as Senior Vice President of Human Resources. He had a major hand in the process, putting the first list together for Reg and watching over the succession race on a daily basis. Ted revolutionized the human resources function at GE. He challenged the old boys' status quo and began pushing a meritocracy. Reg had come to count on Ted as a sounding board. In late January 1979, Reg asked me inside his office and closed the door for what I later understood to be one of the first of his famous airplane interviews with all the candidates. The previous chairman, Fred Borch, had used a similar interview to pick Reg. "Jack, you and I are flying in one of the company planes, and the plane crashes," said Reg. "Who should be the next chairman of General Electric?" Most candidates, including me, immediately and instinctively tried to crawl out of the wreckage and take control of the company. Reg politely explained that wasn't possible. We were both on the plane. I tried to argue that I had survived the crash. No, he said. "You and I are killed. Who should be the chairman?" I fumbled around, struggling with the answer. I told him I was so confident that I was the best candidate for the job that it was hard for me to give him another name. "Wait a minute," Reg said. "You're done. Who should get the job?" I finally told Reg my vote would go to Ed Hood, who ran the technical products and services business. He's thoughtful and smart and had made Tom Vanderslice the number two guy. Tom's decisive and tough as nails. They would complement each other well. Tom ran the power system sector and, like me, lacked support from either vice chairman. Then, Reg asked my views of each of the other contenders, drawing out my assessment of their strengths and weaknesses. He wanted to know how I rated each guy on intelligence, leadership, integrity, and public image. He was trying to find out who could work with whom. He wasn't about to saddle his successor, as he had been, with a couple of unhappy vice chairmen. In these interviews, repeated over several months, Reg gathered the opinions of all the top executives, including senior officers who weren't in the race. When Reg compiled the results of these sessions with 9 different executives, no one gave the top job to me. 7 of those interviewed favored Stan Galt, 2 named Ed Hood. Another time, in June, Reg asked me to come in again. "Remember our airplane conversations?" he asked. "Yeah," I replied. "You killed me." Reg laughed. "Well, this time we're out there together. We're flying in a plane, and the plane crashes." "Not again," I complained. "Jack, this time I'm done, but you live. Now, who should be the chairman of General Electric?" "That's better. I'm the guy," I said without hesitation. Reg asked who should be on my leadership team. I told him that among all the candidates in the race, I would most want to work with Hood and Burlingame. Once again, I emphasized that the best fit with me would be Hood. I added Burlingame because I genuinely respected his intelligence, his analytical abilities, and his comfort with himself. "Okay, if you're the man, what do you see ahead as the major challenges facing the company?" I told Reg exactly what I thought, as I'm sure every candidate did. Reg shared our views and thoughts with the Management Development and Compensation Committee of the board, then chaired by Ralph Lazarus, chairman of Federated Department Stores. Apparently, when Reg tallied up the results of these sessions in which he had asked each person to name 3 executives for the top leadership team, I fared much better. Galt still got the most votes, 7, while Hood and I were tied with 6 each. Through these interviews, Reg kept his usual poker face. He never gave any of us a hint if we were in good shape or not. At times, he could appear remote and hard to connect with. He showed no bias or preference, at least to me, and because of our many surface differences, I wasn't at all sure that he would eventually pick me. He was, it appeared, an English statesman, and I was an Irish street kid. On the surface, at least, he appeared to be the opposite of me. Yet few people, including me, knew that Reg had grown up on the outside looking in. He was portrayed as a courtly statesman. He was written up as an advisor to 3 presidents and their cabinets, a man who one reporter said looked like an industrious church deacon. He was and is all those things. But what many people missed was that Reg was not privileged. He was a self-made man from working-class roots who worked and fought hard for what he achieved. Borrowing the Bob Hope line, Reg put it best, "I'm English. I'm too damn poor to be British." Reg grew up in a row house in Stoke-on-Trent. His dad worked as a foreman in a steel mill, and his mother itched for a better life in the United States. Reg finally arrived in America at the age of 8.5 years in an English boy's school uniform and moved just outside Trenton, New Jersey. Whatever accent he brought was quickly knocked out of him in the schoolyard by kids who felt threatened by a smart outsider. Both his parents got jobs in a local factory, the Acme Rubber Manufacturing Company. His mother was a piece worker, sorting and packing rubber jar rings meant for the lids of mason jars. His dad was an electrician's helper. Reg excelled at school, working his way through the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School by tutoring other students and shelving books in the university library. When he graduated in 1939, he went straight to GE and climbed up the ranks through the company's powerful finance function. Reg did an 8-year tour in the audit staff that took him to nearly every plant and every business of the company. He was an operating manager in several businesses before being named chief financial officer in 1968, a post that set him up for the chairman's job 4 years later. Reg and I were clearly very different people, but we also had a lot of hidden similarities. Both of us were hard-working people from modest backgrounds. Like me, he was an only child whose parents were remarkably similar to my own. Our success in the only company either of us ever worked for was a tribute to the organization's meritocracy. We both loved numbers and analyses. We both did our homework and showed little tolerance for anyone who didn't. Outsiders who for years have scratched their heads over how Reg could have chosen someone so different from himself never realized the links we shared. Neither did I until writing this book. We were considerably more alike than anyone imagined. The first big break in the race came in early August 1979, 18 months after I first came to Fairfield. On Thursday night, August 2nd, after a board outing at the Blind Brook Country Club near Rye, New York, Reg sat down with his two vice chairmen and told them he was going to narrow the race down to three candidates, myself, Burlingame, and Hood. The remaining candidates would keep their current jobs or leave the company. He said he would ask the board the next morning for approval to name the three of us as vice chairmen. Both Parker and Dance would have to retire by the end of the year. The next morning, Parker and Dance gave their opinions to the full board, essentially opposing Reg's position that I be the third candidate. At least one of the board's most powerful directors strongly supported Galt, and there was some additional backing for Al Way because of his financial expertise. However, the board swung Reg's way, including Parker and Dance, who backed off and made the vote unanimous. To his credit, a clearly disappointed Parker summoned me to his office. "I want you to hear this from me and not anyone else," he said. "I didn't support you, and I don't think you're the right guy to run GE. I don't want you to screw this company up." I admired his candor, even though I disagreed with his assessment. What I wouldn't know for many years was that Reg had already made up his mind. He wanted me to be the next CEO of the company, but a few directors still favored other candidates. By putting the three of us on the board as vice chairman, Reg was betting that a longer look would sway the other directors in my favor. Over the next few months, Galt, Vanderslice, Way, Parker, and Dance left the company. For the next 2 years, Burlingame, Hood, and I reported directly to Reg. The atmosphere cleared and the politics disappeared. Reg's airplane interviews had assured him that the three of us could work well together as a team, and we did. Toward the end, Reg made one final request of all the candidates. He asked each of us to write a detailed memo that assessed our own performance as a vice chairman, a director, and a company representative. He also asked us to write about our personal growth and how we met what Reg called the test of stewardship, what the corporation should bring to society. I was still worried about a more basic concern, that Reg and the board might pass me over because of my age. At 44, I was the youngest of the three final candidates. John Burlingame was 58. Ed Hood was 50. I considered including in my memo a promise not to hold the office for more than 10 years if I got it. I thought a pledge would offset some concern about my age and the possibility I would be in the job too long. When I told my close friend, Anthony Lofi Lofrisco, about this, he thought I was out of my mind. Lofi is a New York lawyer I met at Silver Spring Country Club shortly after coming to Fairfield. One Sunday afternoon, by the pool at my home in New Canaan, we got into a fierce argument over my idea of proposing a term limit. He insisted I would forever regret doing it. "Once you get in that office, you'll never leave," he said. "The only way they'll get you out of there is if they entomb you in your office with cinder blocks." "Get out of here," I said. "You're crazy." Larry Bossidy and his family were there, and Larry ended up on Lofrisco's side. Ultimately, I agreed with them and dropped it. Lofi hasn't failed to remind me about his great contribution to my career for at least the past 10 years. I later discovered that my concern was real, although not terribly serious. A couple of directors had been suggesting that Reg should name Burlingame the next chairman for a short period of time as a bridge before naming me. Reg apparently diffused the issue by telling the board that I would in all likelihood leave the company if I didn't get the job. He was right. I spent a lot of time crafting an 8-page memo and sent it to Reg, noting, It may be more about Welch than we both need or want to know. The letter is more stiff and formal than what I would write today. However, it was something that at 44 I felt I needed to overcome my immature image. Still, it contained many of the ideas I would in fact implement over the next 20 years. In it, I dealt head-on with the concerns some colleagues may have had with me, including my perceived lack of maturity and sensitivity. I argued that all of my experiences at GE over 20 years, coupled with my personal growth, had given me the necessary maturity for the job and the sensitivity needed in the CEO's stewardship role. I attempted to deal with my demanding nature by writing, "While I have and will continue to demand that people attain high performance standards, I have at the same time provided numerous leapfrog opportunities to promising employees and have helped create an atmosphere which attracts talented and ambitious men and women." One line I liked summed up what I thought about leadership. "The people with whom I have been associated have worked harder, enjoyed it more, although not always initially, and in the end gained increased self-respect and self-confidence from accomplishing more than they previously thought possible." I explained that I learned something valuable by my failure to complete the Cox acquisition. I had discovered that Wall Street's reaction to both the proposed deal and its cancellation was general disinterest, even though its cost was in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and it was in a highly attractive and visible industry. Because GE was so large, the deal's impact was not considered significant. It reinforces my view that what we have to sell as an enterprise to the equity investor is consistent, above-average earnings growth throughout the economic cycle, I wrote. Our size may dictate that as the only option. The discipline to balance both short and long-term is the absolute of such a strategy. Little did I know when writing this letter how true this fundamental belief would turn out to be. Finally, I also put in a strong pitch for the job. "There is a great distance today," I wrote Reg, "between where you are and all three of us stand. However, I feel I have the intellectual capacity, breadth, discipline, and most of all, the leadership to get there. General Electric has been my business life, and its importance to me has grown with each succeeding year. Whether I can properly assemble and discharge the multiple responsibility is for others to judge, but obviously I would like the chance." I was selling runway, the capacity to grow, something I've always looked for in every appointment I have made. I always bet on runway. I felt it was a good bet to put people in stretch jobs early in their careers. Far more often than not, they brought a lot more excitement and passion to the job and achieved greater personal growth for themselves. As for where I stood, I started getting positive vibes in the summer of 1980. Dave Orsolet, my human resources staffer and a real friend, was picking up tidbits from Ted Levino, the corporate HR head. While Dave reported directly to Ted and was loyal to him, he couldn't withstand my relentless pumping for information. I remember one time during a party at my house, I had poured Dave pinned against the refrigerator in my kitchen, drilling him on how he thought the race would play out. That was probably my worst transgression. Bless his heart, Dave would never tell me I was the front runner, but he reluctantly divulged just enough information to make me feel upbeat about the eventual outcome. The first board indication that I might be the front-runner came in September 1980, when one of GE's board members called with an unusual invitation. Ed Littlefield, a major shareholder from his sale of Utah International to GE in the late 1970s, asked me to be his partner at the Cypress Point Member Guest Tournament in California. Littlefield was on our board as chairman of Utah International. When he sold Utah to Reg, he became one of GE's largest shareholders. I thought that he wouldn't be inviting me if I wasn't Reg's choice. It was my first time at Cypress Point and a huge treat for me. Ed wanted to introduce me to all his West Coast friends. My Irish luck struck again. The first day of the tournament, we had a shotgun start and began on the sixth hole. On the seventh, a par three, I stepped up to the tee and hit a 4-iron into the hole. It was my first hole-in-one after 30 years of golf, and it came at Cypress Point on the second hole I ever played there. That sure made it easy to meet everyone. Littlefield was one of many directors whose outspoken boardroom support made a big difference. He was an enthusiastic advocate for me, along with Cy Cathcart, G.G. Michelson, Henry Hillman, Walter Wriston, and John Lawrence. Five of these six directors would play very important roles for me in years to come. Cy, then the chairman of Illinois Tool Works, was the easiest and most natural guy in the world to be with. I liked him the first time we met. He had remarkable common sense and a unique feel for every situation. Cy has helped me every year I had the job as CEO, even agreeing to come out of retirement to run Kidder Peabody when it got into trouble. I was impressed with Gigi, then a relatively new board member from R.H. Macy & Company, though I didn't appreciate how incredibly smart, savvy, and creative she was until later. She has been an insightful confidant and played a major role in every big decision I made at GE. Henry Hillman was an exciting entrepreneur, a risk-taker, someone I loved to talk with. He was bright, rich, and funny, and he never took himself too seriously. He abhorred pomposity as much as I did. He was always asking, "Are we going fast enough?" John Lawrence, a Boston Brahmin and global cotton trader who rode the very same commuter train my father worked on as a conductor, had been on the GE board for 23 years. He loved golf and always played around with me at GE events. We always had fun together. John had seen it all and was a close confidant of Reg's. He reached mandatory retirement age just after my appointment. As chairman of Citicorp, Wriston was one of the most influential directors on the board and was America's leading banker in the 1970s and 1980s. My first encounter with him was at a board outing at Disney World in 1979. He was trying to recruit Dennis Dammerman, then a vice president and controller at GE Capital, to a big job at Citicorp. I went after him, teasing him about being a board member and trying to steal one of my best executives. I think he got a kick out of my attack. That candor could have been the kiss of death or the beginning of an enduring friendship. It turned out to be the latter. Walter was as tough and smart as they made them, with a wry sense of humor. But when he liked someone, he was really supportive. He was with me from day one. They were among the directors who backed Reg in the boardroom and allowed him to come into my office on that December 15, 1980, to embrace me. On that wintry Monday, Reg told me that he had recommended me for the job and the board unanimously supported it at a dinner meeting on November 20th. Reg had given the board a month's time to reflect on its conclusion and to raise any issues they wanted after the vote. There were none. Reg told me I would be formally elected chairman at the upcoming board session on Friday, December 19th. He explained that Hood and Burlingame would stay as my vice chairman and that he would spend the next 3 months to help me through the transition until I officially took over on April 1st. This all happened because Reg had the courage to pick someone who was 180 degrees from what was then the model GE executive. It had been a difficult struggle to get here. I now had the job, but some silly politics remained. To give you a sense of how thick the politics were at the time, Paolo Fresco, then a vice president, recalls being nearly physically confronted in a Fairfield hallway by an overzealous executive who reported to Burlingame yet supported me. Fresco remembers being called a jackass simply because he was loyal to his own boss. Shortly after I was named chairman-elect, Paolo came to me. "Jack," he said in true Italian political style, "I give you my resignation. I want you to know I was supporting Burlingame and my candidate lost." I told him to stuff his resignation. I wasn't thinking about who did or didn't support me. The Italian-born Fresco, the most global guy I have ever met, later became one of my closest friends. As vice chairman, he played a major role in making GE a truly global corporation. But this was mostly a time for celebration. In its story announcing the decision, the Wall Street Journal reported that GE decided to replace a legend with a live wire. To introduce me to the corporate elite, Reg planned a coming-out party for me at the Helmsley Palace in New York City on February 24th, just before I officially took over on April 1st. Reg wanted to introduce me to his friends and transfer his relationships to me. It was a big affair, attended by the CEOs of the country's biggest corporations at the time. It was a terrific bash. I had a ball. Everyone was relaxed, and nearly everyone drank a little too much, except Reg, who wanted to make sure I was introduced to every one of the 50 or 60 guests. He wanted to get me off to a perfect start, but when Reg asked me to make a few remarks late in the evening, unknown to me, he apparently felt I slurred a few of my words. First thing next morning, he came into my office as mad as I have ever seen him. "I've never been so humiliated in my life," Reg told me. "You embarrassed me and the company." I was stunned. I'd had a fantastic time and thought it was a great party. For the next 4 hours, I think I felt every emotion known to man. I felt keenly disappointed that I had let Reg down. I was mad as hell at him because I thought he was being a stiff. I felt sorry for myself because maybe I hadn't made the great impression I thought I had. I couldn't believe our guests didn't have a great time. They just couldn't have faked it that much. I'd been to enough parties to know a good one. Just before noon, however, things changed. Reg came back to my office. "I want to talk," he said. "Look, I've gotten over 20 calls in the last 3 hours, and everyone is saying it was the best party they've been to in New York in 10 years. I'm sorry. I was too damn tough on you. Everyone had a good time. All I'm hearing are good reports about you and the party. They liked you. I just misread the evening." God, was I relieved. I could hardly wait to get going. Section 2. Building a Philosophy. Chapter 7. Dealing with Reality and Superficial Congeniality. On April 1, 1981, I was like the dog who caught the bus. I finally had the job. Despite all the experiences that had gotten me this far, I wasn't nearly as sure of myself as I pretended to be. Outwardly, I had a pretty good dose of self-confidence, and those who knew me would have described me as self-assured, cocky, decisive, quick, and tough. Inwardly, I still had plenty of insecurities. Whenever I had to get up in front of people, I struggled with my speech impediment. I fussed with a comb-over to disguise my receding hairline. And when someone asked me how tall I was, I had myself believing I was at least an inch and a half taller than the 5'8" I really was. I came to the job without many of the external CEO skills. I had rarely dealt with anyone in Washington, even though the government was more into business than ever. I had little experience dealing with the media. My only press conference was the scripted session with Reg on the day GE announced I would be the next chairman. I had only one or two brief outings before the Wall Street analysts who followed GE, and our 500,000-plus shareholders had no idea who Jack Welch was and whether he would be able to fill the shoes of the most admired businessman in America. But I did know what I wanted the company to feel like. I wasn't calling it culture in those days, but that's what it was. I knew it had to change. The company had many strengths. It was a $25 billion corporation earning $1.5 billion a year with 404,000 employees. It had a AAA balance sheet, and its products and services permeated almost every part of the GNP, from toasters to power plants. Some employees proudly described the company as a super tanker, strong and steady in the water. I respected that, but wanted the company to be more like a speedboat, fast and agile, able to turn on a dime. I wanted GE to run more like the informal plastics business I came from, a company filled with self-confident entrepreneurs who would face reality every day. Every milestone would trigger a celebration that would make business fun. With a few notable exceptions, fun was not the norm at the time. I knew the benefits of staying small, even as GE was getting bigger. The good businesses had to be sorted out from the bad ones. I wanted GE to stay only in businesses that were number one or number two in their markets. We had to act faster and get the damn bureaucracy out of the way. The reality was that at the end of 1980, GE was, like much of American industry, a formal and massive bureaucracy with too many layers of management. It was ruled by more than 25,000 managers who each averaged 7 direct reports in a hierarchy with as many as a dozen levels between the factory floor and my office. More than 130 executives held the rank of vice president or above, with all kinds of titles and support staffs behind each one. Vice president of corporate financial administration, vice president of corporate consulting, and vice president of corporate operating services. There were 8 regional or consumer relations vice presidents located around the country without direct sales responsibility. The bureaucracy this structure created was huge. Today, in a company 6 times as large, we have roughly 25% more vice presidents. We have fewer managers, and most now average over 15 direct reports, not 7, with in most cases fewer than 6 layers between the shop floor and the CEO. It didn't take very long to bump up against some of the worst practices. A couple of months into the job, Art Beeka, the head of our R&D operation, stopped by my office. He wanted to give me a series of cards with written questions for our upcoming planning sessions with GE business leaders. The centerpiece of these meetings, held every July, were thick planning books that contained detailed forecasts of sales, profits, capital expenditures, and myriad other numbers for the next 5 years. These books were the lifeblood of the bureaucracy. Some GE staffers in Fairfield actually graded them, even assigning points to the pizzazz of each cover. It was nuts. I looked through the cards Art handed me, surprised to see corporate crib sheets filled with "I gotcha" questions. What the hell am I supposed to do with these? I always give the corporate executive office these questions. That lets them show the operating people that they studied the planning books, he replied. Art, this is crazy, I said. These meetings have got to be spontaneous. I want to see their stuff for the first time and react to it. The planning books get the conversation going. The last thing I wanted was a series of tough technical questions to score a few points. What was the purpose of being CEO if I couldn't ask my own questions? The corporate staff had its rear end to the field, and it was too busy kissing up to the bosses. The corporate executive office, including my vice chairman, wasn't the only group at headquarters getting crib sheets. For every business review, headquarters people loaded up their own staff heads with questions. We had dozens of people routinely going through what I considered dead books. All my career, I never wanted to see a planning book before the person presented it. To me, the value of these sessions wasn't in the books. It was in the heads and hearts of the people who were coming into Fairfield. I wanted to drill down, to get beyond the binders and into the thinking that went into them. I needed to see the business leaders' body language and the passion they poured into their arguments. There were too many passive reviews. One annual ritual was the spring trip to the appliance product review in Louisville. A team of designers and engineers hauled out cardboard and plastic mock-ups. Here we were from Fairfield being asked for our opinions on futuristic refrigerators, stoves, and dishwasher models. I'll never know how many of these models ever made it to the dealer's selling floor. I did know that some of the mock-ups had to have the dust brushed off them because they had been paraded out in prior reviews for years. I also knew that the comments from the Fairfield contingent, including myself, were of little value. This ritual was a waste of everyone's time. I wanted to break the cycle of these dog and pony shows. Hierarchy's role to passively review and approve had to go. After the planning sessions my first summer, I tried to create the environment I was looking for with my own staff. I thought a good way to break the ice was to take everyone off-site for a couple of days. In my earlier jobs, we always found a way to make sure we got a dose of golf mixed with the business at first-class golf courses, places like Harbortown at Hilton Head and the Cascades at the Homestead. I had just become a member of Laurel Valley, a wonderful golf club just outside Pittsburgh. So in the fall of 1981, I invited about 14 executives to Laurel for the 2-day retreat. The group included all the functional staff heads and our 7 sector executives. It was my first real attempt at creating a collegial group at the top, what we would later call the CEC, or Corporate Executive Council. Among the 14 executives, a core group of at least 7 or 8 advocates signed up for the new agenda. Reg was right when he picked John Burlingame and Ed Hood as vice chairs. They were supportive and never undermined my efforts, despite the fact that they may have had some reservations about the pace of change. Together, in fact, they served as a moderating force. Larry Bossidy, the guy I had discovered over a ping-pong table, had come to Fairfield as a sector executive in 1981 and had become a business soulmate. We both shared a hatred of bureaucracy. I had strong support from two of my most senior staff guys, Chief Financial Officer Tom Thorson and Human Resources Chief Ted Lovino. Tom was an old associate from Pittsfield. He had been tapped a few years earlier by Reg to come to Fairfield as CFO. He understood what we wanted to do. While he thought it was a sport to take shots at me, I still loved him for his candor and his smarts. Lovino represented the bridge between the old and the new GE. His support for many of the early initiatives was vital. If I didn't have all 14 of our top executives completely behind me at this moment, I knew I had enough to start the process. The first morning at Laurel Valley, I filled a conference room with blank easels, anxious to capture everyone's thoughts. I got up in front of the crowd and started asking what they thought about our number one or number two strategy, what they liked and disliked about GE, and what things we ought to change quickly. We spent time discussing the just-concluded planning sessions and how they could be improved. Creating an open dialogue was difficult. Only those I worked closely with were willing to let it rip. Most of the guys didn't want to stick their necks out. We got through the mornings with only half the group engaged. After a fun afternoon of golf and a few drinks over dinner, things loosened up a little bit and a few more got involved. The second day was more of the same. Perhaps it was too early. Many of them weren't sure where they stood or what they were dealing with. The two-day outing failed to build any kind of consensus for change. I thought we needed a revolution. It was obvious we weren't going to get one with this team. GE's culture had been built for a different time when a command and control structure made sense. Having been in the field, I had a strong prejudice against most of the headquarters staff. I felt they practiced what could be called superficial congeniality, pleasant on the surface with distrust and savagery roiling beneath it. The phrase seems to sum up how bureaucrats typically behave, smiling in front of you but always looking for a gotcha behind your back. Organizational layers were another residue of size. I use the analogy of putting on too many sweaters. Sweaters are like layers. They are insulators. When you go outside and you wear four sweaters, it's difficult to know how cold it is. On one early plant tour in a Lynn, Massachusetts jet engine factory, I ended up in the boiler room with a group of employees who knew many of the guys I grew up with in Salem. During a casual conversation about old times, I happened to learn that they had four layers of management supervising the boiler operation. I couldn't believe it. It was a funny way to find out about layers. I used that story at every opportunity. Another effective analogy was comparing an organization to a house. Floors represent layers, and the walls, functional barriers. To get the best out of an organization, these floors and walls must be blown away, creating an open space where ideas flow freely, independent of rank or function. In the 1970s and 1980s, big business had too many layers, too many sweaters, too many floors and walls. The impact of these layers was seen most easily in the capital appropriations request process. When I first became CEO, almost every request for a significant capital expenditure would come to me for approval. A package of paper would arrive on my desk for a signature to buy something like a $50 million mainframe computer. In some cases, 16 other people had already signed it, and my signature was the last one required. What value was I adding? I did away with that process and haven't signed an appropriations approval in at least 18 years. Each business leader has the same delegation of authority that the board gave me. At the beginning of every year, the business made the case for the capital it needed. We allocated the dollars, ranging from $50 million to several hundred million. They own it and decide how far to delegate the spending authority. The people closest to the work know the work best. They become more accountable. They take their recommendations more seriously if they know a bunch of signatures aren't piled on top of them. In those days, I was throwing hand grenades, trying to blow up traditions and rituals that I felt held us back. In the fall of 1981, I tossed one in the middle of the Elfin Society, an internal management club at GE. ELFIN was short for Electrical Funds, a mutual fund that its members could invest in. It was a networking group for white-collar types. Being an ELFIN was considered a rite of passage into management. I didn't have a lot of respect for what ELFIN was doing. I thought it represented the height of superficial congeniality. It evolved into an elitist group for those who wanted to be seen by their bosses or their bosses' bosses at dinner meetings. I remember paying dues and going to a few of these dinners early in my career. If a corporate vice president who oversaw a business in the town showed up, he'd get a packed house. Everyone would go to win points and get face time. If the speaker had no real impact on their careers, ELFIN would have trouble filling a small conference room. As the new CEO, I was invited to speak before the group's annual leadership conference in the fall of 1981. It was supposed to be a nice meeting, one of those pat-on-the-back speeches from the new guy. I showed up at the Longshore Country Club in Westport, Connecticut, where some 100 ELFIN leaders from all the local chapters in the United States gathered. After dinner, I got up and delivered what one member still remembers as a classic stick-in-the-eye speech. Thank you for asking me to speak. Tonight, I'd like to be candid, and I'll start by letting you reflect on the fact that I have serious reservations about your organization. I described ELFIN as an institution pursuing yesterday's agenda. I told them I never could identify with their recent activities. I can't find any value to what you're doing, I said. You're a hierarchical, social, and political club. I'm not going to tell you what you should do or be. It's your job to figure out a role that makes sense for you and GE. There was stunned silence when I ended the speech. I tried to soften the blow by milling around the bar for an hour. However, no one was in the mood for cheering up. The next morning, one of our senior officers, Frank Doyle, went, as he always did, to meet with the group at its opening business session. This time, he had a real job. He had to pick up the pieces from my speech the evening before. Frank just about walked into a wake. They felt as if they had been run over by a train. Like me, the night before, he challenged them to change. A month later, ELFIN President Cal Niethammer called me and asked for a meeting. I invited Cal, an engineer in our transportation business in Erie, Pennsylvania, to Fairfield for lunch. He came armed with charts, but more important, he was excited about a new idea for ELFIN. His dream was to turn the organization into an army of GE community volunteers. The idea came at a time when President Reagan was urging people to volunteer their time, to step in where government was reducing its role. God, was I excited by Cal's vision. I've never forgotten that lunch. Although Cal retired a few years ago, I still hear from him more or less once a year. What a job he and his successors did. Today, ELFIN has more than 42,000 members, including retirees. They volunteer their time and energy in communities where GE has plants or offices. They have mentoring programs for high school students that have achieved remarkable results. At Aiken High School, an inner-city school in Cincinnati, coaching by GE volunteers raised the percentage of graduating students going on to college to more than 50% from less than 10% in the past 10 years. Similar programs are going on in schools in every significant GE community, including Albuquerque, Cleveland, Durham, Erie, Houston, Richmond, Schenectady, Jakarta, Bangalore, and Budapest. They've also done everything from building parks, playgrounds, and libraries to repairing tape players for the blind. Today, no one is excluded from the organization, whether the person is a factory worker or a senior executive. Membership is determined solely by the desire to give back. Some 20 years later, the organization I almost turned my back on has become one of the best things about GE. I love the organization, the people in it, what it stands for, and what it has done. ELFIN's self-engineered turnaround became a very important symbol. It was just what I was looking for. Not everything I wanted to change was at headquarters. Some of the real eye-openers were far from my office. I spent most of 1981 with a team in the field reviewing businesses, just as I had done for 10 years. I had a good feel for about a third of the company and wanted to dig into the rest. I quickly found that the bureaucracy I saw when managing appliances and lighting was nothing compared to what I would see in some of GE's other operations. The bigger the business, the less engaged people seem to be. From the forklift drivers in a factory to the engineers packed in cubicles, too many people were just going through the motions. Passion was hard to find. Schenectady, the home of our power turbine business, was particularly frustrating. It had been our flagship business for GE for a long time, replacing lighting, our first business, as the core of the company. It had great technology, and its gas turbines were the envy of the world. With $2 billion in sales and 26,000 employees, more than 20,000 in Schenectady, it was important, and it acted important, despite only making $61 million of net income. Power represented much of what had to change, not the technology and products, but the attitudes. Too many managers considered their positions as rewards for service to the company, a career capstone rather than a fresh opportunity. There was an attitude that customers were fortunate to place orders for their wonderful machines. The long-cycle nature of the business with product life cycles and order backlogs measured in years only compounded the lack of pace, excitement, and energy. Little did I know that out of all these field visits, I'd stumble upon a relatively small and troubled business that would prove to be a big help. It was our nuclear reactor business in San Jose, California. Nuclear power was one of GE's three big 1960s ventures, along with computers and aircraft engines. Our engine business was going strong, but computers had already been sold, and our nuclear business was filled primarily with hope. No business was undergoing more change than the nuclear power industry at that moment. Only 2 years earlier, in 1979, the Three Mile Island reactor accident in Pennsylvania put an end to what little public support remained for nuclear energy. Utilities and governments were reevaluating their investment plans for a nuclear future. Ironically, this once promising GE business would become the perfect role model for my reality theme. The people who worked in San Jose were among the best and brightest of their time. Coming out of graduate school in the 1950s and 60s, they had invested their lives in the promise of nuclear energy. They were the Bill Gateses of their generation, expecting to change the way we live and work. In the spring of 1981, I visited this billion-dollar business. During my two-day review, the leadership team presented a rosy plan, assuming three new orders for nuclear reactors a year. They had a terrific track record in the early 1970s, selling 3 to 4 reactors each year. The business saw the Three Mile Island disaster as little more than a blip. Their view was completely at odds with reality. They had received no new orders in the last 2 years and had suffered a $13 million loss in 1980. Though they would turn a small profit in 1981, the reactor side of the business by itself was on its way to a $27 million loss. I listened for a while before interrupting with what they saw as a bombshell. "Guys, you're not going to get 3 orders a year," I said. "In my opinion, you'll never get another order for a nuclear reactor in the U.S. They were shocked. They argued, with the not-so-subtle implication being, "Jack, you really don't understand this business." That was probably true, but I had the benefit of a pair of fresh eyes. I hadn't invested my life in this business. I loved their passion, even though I felt it was misdirected. Their arguments contained a lot of emotion, but few facts. I asked them to redo the plan on the assumption they'd never get another U.S. order for a reactor. "You figure out how to make a business out of selling just fuel and nuclear services to the installed base," I said. At the time, GE had 72 active reactors in service. Safety was the principal preoccupation of both utility managers and government regulators. We had an obligation and an opportunity to keep those reactors up and running safely. Obviously, our review didn't go well. I had thrown a bucket of cold water on their dreams. Toward the end of our meeting, they resorted in frustration to one of the favorite, "when all else fails," arguments heard in business. "If we take the orders out of the plan, you'll kill morale, and you'll never be able to mobilize the business when the orders come back." That wasn't the first or the last time I heard desperate business teams use the argument. That reasoning falls into the same category as the other plea I often heard during tough times. "You've cut all the fat out, now you're into bone, and you'll ruin the business if we cut more." Both arguments don't make it. They're both weak. Management always has a tendency to take the smallest bite of the cost apple. Inevitably, managers have to keep going back again and again to cut more as markets deteriorate. All this does is create more uncertainty for employees. I've never seen a business ruin because it reduced its cost too much too fast. When good times come again, I've always seen business teams mobilize quickly and take advantage of the situation. Fortunately, the leader of this business, Dr. Roy Beaton, was the most realistic GE trooper in the room. He reluctantly accepted the challenge. I left not knowing what I'd get. During the summer, we had a few more heated exchanges when the team pleaded its case to put one or two reactors in the plant instead of three. I remained stubbornly committed to zero and the full development of a fuel and services business. To their credit, by the fall of 1981, the team, now headed by Warren Brueggemann, who succeeded the retiring Beaton, had a plan and was prepared to implement it. They reduced the size of the salaried employees in the reactor business from 2,410 in 1980 to 160 by 1985. They eliminated most of the reactor infrastructure and focused only on research for advanced reactors in the event the day would come when the world's view of nuclear changed. The service business became very successful and was an early indicator that service could play a huge role in GE's future. With its success, nuclear's overall net earnings grew from $14 million in 1981 to $78 million in 1982 and to $116 million in 1983. Some 20 years after that first meeting, the business has gotten orders for only four of their technologically advanced reactors. Not one of them has come from the United States. The team built a profitable fuel and services business that has made money every year. The nuclear business kept GE's obligations to the utility's installed base and invested consistently to support advanced reactor research. Their story of success was one of the thrills of my early days as CEO. It had little to do with economics, but a lot to do with the company feel I was looking for. The people who engineered the transformation at our nuclear business were not typical Jack Welch types. They weren't young, loud, or confrontational. They didn't see the bureaucracy as the enemy. They were GE careerists and mainstreamers. The opportunity to make heroes out of people who were not obvious Welch disciples was a breakthrough. It sent a clear message. You didn't have to fit a certain stereotype to be successful in the new GE. You could be a hero no matter what you looked like or how you acted. All you had to do was face reality and perform. That message was a big deal at a time when some GE people were unsure where they stood or whether or not they had some kind of nut running the company. I used this nuclear story over and over again in the first few years as CEO to pound home the need for a reality check. I shouted it out from every rooftop. Facing reality sounds simple, but it isn't. I found it hard to get people to see a situation for what it is and not for what it was or what they hoped it would be. Don't kid yourself. It is the way it is. My mother's admonition to me many years ago was just as important for GE. In a business plan, there's little percentage in betting on hope. Self-delusion can grip an entire organization and lead the people in it to ridiculous conclusions. Whether it was appliances in the late 1970s, nuclear in the early 1980s, or dot-coms at the turn of the century, getting people to face reality was the first step toward an eventual solution. When I became CEO, I inherited a lot of great things, but facing reality was not one of the company's strong points. Its superficial congeniality made candor extremely difficult to come by. I got lucky. The changes at our nuclear reactor business and at Elfin gave me important weapons to demonstrate what I wanted GE to feel like. I told their stories again and again to every GE audience at every opportunity. For the next 20 years, I used that same storytelling technique to get ideas transferred across the company. Slowly, people started listening. Thank you. Chapter 8, The Vision Thing. My first time in front of Wall Street's analysts as chairman was a bomb. I had been in the job for 8 months when I went to New York City on December 8, 1981, to deliver my big message on the new GE. I had worked on the speech, rewriting it, rehearsing it, and desperately wanting it to be a smash hit. It was, after all, my first